Hello, and welcome back, one and all, to a milestone episode of In Summation, The Final Word, a podcast for inquisitive minds on real-world courtroom drama. This is the 50th episode of the show, and I'm honored and touched by how my community of listeners has grown and how interactive they are with me. I wanted to do something special for the 50th episode. I want to make sure that this episode really meant something to me. In light of that, I want to specifically thank listener Mac Browder, who suggested today's case. I think it's perfect for the occasion. So thanks, Mac. I hope I do it justice. If you've been listening to this program in order, you'll notice that recently I've been doing a lot of recent cases. I've been deliberately trying to discuss trials, which might be a little fresher in people's minds. We're going to take a slight break from that today. We're actually going back nearly 165 years to just before the Civil War. In today's episode, we're going to try to pack in a lot of really interesting discourse. But there's one major takeaway which I want all of you to keep in your minds as we work through today's topics. It's this. When do you go from putting a man on trial to putting an idea on trial? And how does that affect the way the trial will be remembered in history? When you put a man on trial, you consider his specific actions. You look at what the law permits and or prohibits, and you decide whether that individual comported with the law or violated it. But when you put an idea on trial, you're forced to grapple with whether the law is moral or ethical. You have to judge the idea not based on guilt or innocence, but on whether it has merit. Do you fundamentally agree with its precepts? Does the idea offend you, or do you support it? Would you die for it? Or would you recant under the threat of a death sentence? With that, we turn to today's case, which takes us back to 1859. James Buchanan was president, who's best remembered for being the only president who wasn't married. Many have speculated that James Buchanan was also the first homosexual president, based on his relationship with a man named William Rufus King, though that's never been definitively proven. 1859 saw Oregon added as the 33rd state in the Union. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court was Roger Taney, who infamously authored the Dred Scott decision, which many people believe to be the worst Supreme Court decision ever penned. On a lighter note, 1859 was also the year Joshua Abraham Norton proclaimed himself Emperor of the United States from San Francisco. Politically, Emperor Norton wasn't taken terribly seriously, but he did become something of a tourist spectacle in San Francisco, and there are still many attractions in the city named for him and for his entertaining antics. But there was tension in the air in 1859, especially among the East Coast states. During the decade of the 1850s, the institution of slavery, already a particularly divisive issue, had become more and more prominent. The United States had acquired land after the Mexican-American War and needed to determine whether slavery would be permitted there. Debates raged. Arguments over slavery ended relationships, split families, and destroyed countless friendships. Activists on both sides of the slavery issue were becoming more and more extreme. Abolitionists were sometimes quietly and sometimes loudly assisting runaway slaves come to northern states to live lives of freedom. Southern states, which were seeing a declining economy and increased pressure from northern states to end the institution, which many of them thought was the only way to keep their livelihoods at all, began to increasingly vocalize displeasure with feeling like they were being subjects of the imperial northern states. If you remember your high school American history class, you'll recall that the dividing line at the time, which separated the states where slavery was legal and where it had been abolished, was the Mason-Dixon line, which ran between Pennsylvania and Maryland and between Maryland and Delaware. But even in the slave states, which bordered or were at least close to the Mason-Dixon line, many people opposed the absolutely horrific institution of slavery. On October 16, 1859, one staunch abolitionist had had enough. He gathered up three of his sons, a group of supporters, and set off from a farmhouse he had rented to Harper's Ferry, Now, in 1859, there was not yet a West Virginia, so Harper's Ferry would have still been considered a part of Virginia. In the early morning hours of October 17th, the posse had seized the federal armory and arsenal and captured many of the town's prominent citizens. The hope was that by inciting a local slave population to join the raid, that would begin to move throughout the South, amassing an ever-growing slave army to once and for all put an end to slavery. Harper's Ferry was also an important railway station, and the contents of the armory there were to be sent to the revolts in the South to help an organic and grassroots uprising. You see, this particular man had a code, a moral code, which he could no longer endure violating. He steadfastly believed that no human being should own another human being. He believed it was sinful, evil, and violated the dignity and humanity of the individual, both as a slave and as an owner. He was repulsed that the United States Congress was not acting to end the practice once and for all, and he decided that if the government was not going to do what was right, then he would be the spark that ignited the TNT barrel for them. Now, there was no uniform slave rebellion of 1859 supplied by the armaments from the Harper's Ferry Armory. So in that very concrete sense, our protagonist failed. But in a very real sense, his actions forced this country to finally come to a head, to take sides, and to engage in what would be the bloodiest conflict in our country's history. By the afternoon of October 17, 1859, United States Marines, led by Colonel Robert E. Lee, had arrived in Harper's Ferry. They stormed the armory and killed many of the supporters. Within weeks, the abolitionist was put on trial for treason against the Commonwealth of Virginia, for murder, and for insurrection. He was convicted and executed by December 2nd of that same year. But in those 46 days, John Brown did more to eradicate slavery than any other person in history before him. This is the Commonwealth of Virginia versus John Brown. John Brown was born May 9th, 1800, in a town called Torrington, Connecticut, which is in the northwest corner of the state. His father, Owen Brown, was a wealthy cattle breeder and land speculator. Owen Brown was also a vocal abolitionist and is credited as one of the original founders and facilitators of the Underground Railroad. Owen was a devoutly religious man and believed that the church teachings were incompatible with the institution of slavery. He dedicated much of his life to ending the practice. His mother, Ruth Mills, was the daughter of an officer in the Revolutionary Army, Gideon Mills. The Browns were a very respectable family. John was the fourth of eight children born to Owen and Ruth. In his childhood, the family relocated to Hudson, Ohio, which at the time was probably one of the most anti-slavery areas in the entire country. His mother, Ruth, passed away when he was a child in 1808, and Brown felt the pain of her loss for years. Brown's father, Owen, became a very prominent citizen and operated a highly successful tannery, where he employed Jesse Grant, the father of future general and president Ulysses S. Grant. As was the custom in the early 1800s, by the age of 12, Brown was considered capable of and expected to work full-time. He worked with a cattle company, and according to multiple accounts and interviews he gave while awaiting execution, he was on a cattle drive when he was 12 years old. The company had ventured into a slave state. While there, he was hired by a local man to work alongside an African-American child of around the same age. The other boy was beaten badly with an iron shovel right in front of Brown, who afterwards asked the boy why it had happened. The boy answered that he was a slave and that this was just something that happened frequently. This conversation with the enslaved boy he barely knew had such a profound impact on John Brown that he dedicated his life going forward to ending slavery once and for all. At the age of 16, Brown left Ohio to move to Massachusetts. His plan was to enroll in Amherst College and to study to become a gospel minister. Unfortunately, he suffered from a terrible eye issue, which caused inflammation, swelling, and near constant irritation if he tried to focus. And this naturally precluded him from pursuing a field in which he would spend the vast majority of his time reading. Ultimately, he ended up returning to Ohio and learning to become a tanner like his father. In 1820, he married Dianth Lusk, the daughter of his widowed housekeeper. Between 1820 and 1832, they had 7 children. But in 1832, Dianth died from complications during childbirth. As an established young man in Ohio, Brown had a deep desire to be more involved in the fight against slavery. He concluded that he could be most useful as a needed stop in the Underground Railroad in New Richmond, Pennsylvania, which is in the northwest corner of the state, roughly due north of Pittsburgh. He cleared a piece of the wilderness land he bought, built a cabin and tannery, and installed secret ventilated rooms to house runaway slaves seeking to cross Lake Erie into Canada. Shortly before his wife died, Brown himself had become very sick. His tannery business began to suffer, and he found himself with growing debts. Once he recovered, he had lost his wife. Unable to run his business and manage his household alone, he was remarried to Mary Ann Day, who bore him an additional 13 children. John Brown was what we would consider today to be a man of extreme principle. He was once excommunicated from his church because he invited an African-American man to share his pew. Many of the deacons of the church attempted to change his mind, but Brown told them he would rather be cast out than sacrifice his beliefs. And so he was. And he was never connected with any organized religion ever again. During the 1830s and 1840s, Brown was a member of many organizations which vocally called for the formal and legal end to slavery. He advocated for peaceful action to promote the change he felt was necessary. But in 1850, Congress had passed the Fugitive Slave Act, which mandated that law enforcement agents in free states aid in the return of escaped slaves. It also imposed monetary fines for those caught helping slaves escape. Brown was disgusted, and he formed a militant group dedicated to preventing the reapprehension of runaway slaves called the League of Gileadites. Now, it's around this time that Brown decided that peaceful advocacy was not making sufficient inroads and that a more energetic approach was needed. He began traveling in anti-slavery and abolitionist circles, quietly fundraising. He kept his plan a secret, but he was quietly and slowly raising the funds and arms needed to get his scheme going. Brown had commissioned himself as a modern-day Moses, ready to lead his community of slaves to the Promised Land, a new state that he planned to create specifically for freed slaves. He fervently believed that God put him on the planet to strike the mortal blow against slavery. Among his friends, he counted Frederick Douglass, Sojourner Truth, Harriet Tubman, William Lloyd Garrison, and many others. On July 3rd, 1859, Brown was finally ready. He rented a farmhouse under the name Isaac Smith. There, he waited for the reinforcements he had spent years attracting. The farmhouse was just outside Harper's Ferry, Virginia. His plan was predicated on amassing a volunteer army of about 4,500 men. But by October 16th, 1859, there were 22 men present at the farmhouse, and that was including Brown himself. Nevertheless, believing that the Lord would provide, Brown's regiment entered Harper's Ferry on October 17, 1859, in the early morning hours. They cut the telegraph lines and took control of the train station. They took control of the armory, and they took control of the nearby farms for supplies. There was little to no resistance. But then in the late morning, a B&O railroad train pulled into Harper's Ferry. Yes, B&O Railroad from Monopoly was, in fact, a real railroad line back in the day. Brown initially held the train at the station, but then for reasons I don't think I will ever really understand, he let it proceed to the next station, where they still had working telegraph lines. messages were immediately relayed both to President Buchanan and to Virginia Governor Henry Wise about what was taking place in Harper's Ferry. A local militia then occupied the bridge, which would have been the only real escape route for Brown's men, keeping them pinned down until the Marines arrived. Brown moved his men inside the brick firehouse, but ultimately the Marines, led by Robert E. Lee, broke down the door, killed 10 of Brown's men, and captured 7 more. 5 men, including Brown's son Owen, escaped. Brown himself was injured pretty badly before being captured. Brown's men had killed 4 of the townspeople in the firefight with the Marines. The case of John Brown became the first time in American history where there was actually a legitimate question of jurisdiction. Brown's raid had taken place on federal property. The armory was a federal armory. Now, this implicated federal jurisdiction. The Secretary of War dispatched the United States Attorney for the District of Columbia to go to Harper's Ferry and take charge of the prisoners and put them in federal custody. But Virginia Governor Henry Wise himself immediately went to Harper's Ferry. Wise claimed that murder, treason, and incitement to insurrection were state crimes, so the Commonwealth of Virginia had jurisdiction. Now, there's an interesting nuance here that trips up a lot of people who don't deal in both federal and state criminal systems. There is no federal statute which specifically and simply prohibits murder. Murder is discussed in certain federal provisions, but a federal murder charge under 18 United States Code 1111 only applies when the alleged killing violates a federal law. The homicide itself has to tie in to another violation of a federal statute. Let's take a quick example of this to illustrate the point. In scenario 1, Matt gets into an argument with Pete. Matt decides to kill Pete. He waits outside Pete's home, and when Pete walks outside, Matt pulls out a pistol and shoots Pete in front of his home, killing him. Now let's look at scenario 2. Caitlin runs a nationwide drug trafficking cartel. She gets word that her neighbor, Allison, who also happens to be the cartel accountant, is going to flip on her and testify. Caitlin pays Eric to kill Allison, which he does. In scenario 1, Matt cannot be charged with a federal crime because he has simply committed a murder. Every state has their own penal code, which contains a murder statute, and Matt's actions would fit into each and every one of them. In scenario 2, Caitlin and Eric can both be charged federally with murder, as Allison was going to be a witness in a federal drug trafficking case, and Caitlin and Eric killed her because of her status as a federal witness. Here's another example of when murder can be charged federally. Andrew kidnaps Eric in Texas and drives to Colorado. While being held in Colorado, Eric attempts to escape, and Andrew shoots Eric and kills him. The murder is tied to the federal kidnapping charge because it transversed state lines. So that murder can be charged federally because it relates to another federal crime. Now let's go back to John Brown. In 1859, there was no federal charge for attempting to incite a slave rebellion. Now, technically, there still isn't, but that's beside the point. There was, however, a Virginia statute which very clearly prohibited such an action. Governor Wise took the John Brown situation fairly personally. He contacted President Buchanan and informed him that it was his intention for the Commonwealth of Virginia to seek justice. President Buchanan really didn't seem to care. And just like that, the first real potential jurisdictional grievance was solved. The feds backed down to local authority, and this may be the first and only time the federal government has relinquished a case to a local prosecuting attorney. They almost never do that. Now, this is just my personal opinion, but I think President Buchanan had a pretty good sense that this case could have some serious implications, and that if he were to try to find a way to manufacture a federal charge to get Brown into the federal court system, that abolitionists all over the country might erupt. Leaving him in the care of the Commonwealth of Virginia allowed him not only to wash his hands of the ordeal and keep the federal government out of a particularly sticky cultural issue, but it also tamped down the notoriety of what could have been a massive story. If it was a federal case, that would invite newspaper columns, telegraphs to papers with wide circulation. But maybe, if it was left at the local level, it would get far less attention, and a smaller community would be aware of it. Now, Brown was well known in abolitionist circles, but he was certainly no public figure apart from that. He had spent much of his 30s and 40s looking for work and taking whatever meager jobs he could. A failed mini-rebellion by a nameless ideologue would, in President Buchanan's estimation, blow over, and maybe not cause him such a political headache. Again, this is just my opinion. I can't say for certain why President Buchanan was so amenable to just giving the case to Virginia, but he was. If that actually was his reasoning, however, and I think it might have been, it backfired tremendously. More on that in a few moments. After the arrest, it was decided that the trial of John Brown would take place in Charlestown, not to be confused with Charleston, which is in West Virginia. Charlestown is a few miles west of Harper's Ferry in Jefferson County. Back in the day, they had multiple cities and towns that had very, very similar names. After being arrested, Brown was interrogated by the governor, as well as Virginia Senator James Mason. The 3 hours of questioning yielded sparse useful information, however, as Brown had been struck in the head several times during the Marines' incursion and had lost most of his sense of hearing and was barely conscious. He was accused of very serious felonies. Let's run through a quick refresher on criminal procedure so you can fully understand the swift way the court attempted to mete out justice in this particular case. John Brown was arrested on October 17, 1859. He faced a grand jury roughly 8 days later on October 25th, 1859. The following day, the grand jury had concluded their questioning and returned an indictment against Brown and the other members of his raid for murder, conspiring with slaves to produce an insurrection, and treason against the Commonwealth of Virginia. Then on Tuesday, October 27th, the trial began. That's right, the day after the grand jury returned an indictment, the trial started. Let's examine some of the very serious issues that are immediately apparent with that. Issue number one. The Sixth Amendment to the Constitution guarantees a criminal defendant the right to present a defense. Inherent in that right is the right to investigate, interview witnesses, and take an appropriate amount of time necessary to craft a defense before you can be forced to start a trial. In fact, Brown had requested that the court grant him a very short delay, which was denied. What was the reasoning behind Brown's request for delaying the trial a few short days, you ask? Well, for one, Brown had requested time enough to heal so that his hearing would return, which does not strike me as an unreasonable request. Brown had a legitimate constitutional right to be able to take part in his own trial, meaning he had the right to be able to hear what was going on. That right was denied him without really even a second thought. Reason number two for his request was that he was waiting for his lawyers to arrive. The Commonwealth of Virginia had appointed him two lawyers, John Faulkner and Lawson Botts, both slave owners and staunch pro-slavery advocates. Brown refused to meet or even speak with them. After his arrest, Brown had sent a letter immediately to counsel of his own choice. But the mail was a little bit slower in 1859 than it is in 2023, and travel took significantly longer. So by the 27th, his preferred lawyers had not arrived yet, and in truth, Brown couldn't be sure that they had either received his letter or would even come. The case was presided over by the Honorable Judge Richard Parker, who denied Brown's request for an adjournment. He reasoned that he couldn't be sure if Brown's lawyers were ever even actually going to show up. Moving the trial was unnecessary. The prosecutor, Andrew Hunter, also claimed that a delay would unduly cost the Commonwealth of Virginia, as they were spending nearly $1,000 a day for military guards and extra protection. That works out to be roughly $30,000 in today's money. All told, the Virginia legislature ended up sending about $100,000 to Charlestown to cover the expenses incurred in this particular trial. That brings us to major issue number two. Judge Parker was himself a slave owner and was blatantly and outwardly anxious to get to the sentencing part of the trial as quickly as possible. But Judge Parker also happened to be the paymaster at the Harper's Ferry Armory. So he was less than pleased about Brown's ambitions and intentions for what was to be done with the contents of the armory which employed him. A fair trial is a bedrock principle in our legal system. As Americans, we pride ourselves that our governing document, our federal constitution, as well as our state constitutions, uniformly guarantee that anyone who is accused of a crime, no matter how serious or how petty, is guaranteed a fair trial. We look down at other countries for running corrupt and kangaroo courts. We think of ourselves as this shining beacon on a hill in this regard, because very few other countries will do anything to hamstring law enforcement to ensure that individual rights are actually protected. But enshrined in this right to a fair trial is the right to have your case heard before a judge who is not chomping at the bit to execute you. It would be beyond inconceivable today to have a judge hear a case which related to an armed incursion of the very place where the judge held a second job over an ideological movement which the judge was very vocally opposed to. In 1859, and in many ways continuing through to today, our legal system is grappling with what it really means to have a truly fair trial. I've said on this program before that I don't think it's possible, even in 2023, for a criminal defendant to get a perfectly fair trial. Now, that doesn't mean a defendant can't win at trial, but it does mean that from the very outset, the cards are stacked against him. I can think of very few people who had the cards more stacked against him than John Brown. The prosecutor, Andrew Hunter, was the personal attorney to Virginia Governor Henry Wise, and shared Judge Parker's view on what justice looked like in this case. Hunter was described by a northern newspaper as, quote, a furious advocate for slavery, end quote. Governor Wise made Hunter the prosecutor because the Jefferson County District Attorney, Charles R. Harding, was a drunk and a second-rate attorney, and it was generally conceded he was not up to a case of this importance. Ultimately, there were two hired lawyers who represented Brown, George Hoyt and Hiram Griswold, both hired by abolitionist groups. These men served as Brown's trial lawyers, having to get up to speed on the case instantly, as the trial had already begun by the time they arrived in Jefferson County. As it turned out, the manner in which the court and the prosecutor conducted the trial had the opposite effect from what they intended. They had hoped that by rushing the trial, they would bring a quick and quiet end to what they perceived as dangerous abolitionist violent propaganda. But some northern newspapers had actually picked up on what happened and had sent reporters. Now, knowing that anti-slavery reporters would be barred from entering the courtrooms, the reporters faked credentials from pro-slavery papers to gain access. And what they reported demonstrated the inhuman lengths that the pro-slavery groups would traverse to preserve this abhorrent practice. After the governor had sent a doctor to Brown, ostensibly to conduct a cursory examination of him and declare him healthy enough to stand trial, which of course the doctor did, in reality, Brown was basically brought to court in a wheelbarrow and was so injured that they brought a pallet of wood into the courtroom and put it next to the defense table. And at the beginning of the trial, he spent most of the day lying down on this makeshift cot because he was so injured he was unable to sit up in a chair for any significant length of time. Illustrations were being made and sent to newspapers depicting a badly beaten man laying on a cot of rough wood while court proceeded around him and he could barely even hear it. The central witnesses in Hunter's case against Brown was Colonel Lewis Washington, great-nephew of George Washington, who'd been taken from his farmstead near Harper's Ferry and held hostage. He was a slave owner, and Brown had tried to conscript his slaves into the rebellion. But even during the testimony, Washington conceded that none of his slaves took any active part in Brown's rebellion. There were some other eyewitness accounts of the October 17th raid. Robert E. Lee submitted an affidavit, received into evidence, giving an account of the Marines' actions that day. The only other really significant pieces of evidence were the documents that Brown had signed using the alias Isaac Smith, and a copy of the provisional constitution he had drafted, which was going to be the authoritative document on the anti-slavery government he was trying to institute in his new free state. Here's another interesting tidbit about trial practice in antebellum Virginia. A criminal defendant was not allowed to testify. The legislature had determined that a criminal defendant had too much at stake and was too incentivized not to tell the truth, so they were precluded from taking the stand in their own defense. Brown desperately wanted to testify, but was denied the ability by statute. Now, this is, of course, light years away from the constitutional protection that no one can be compelled to testify in their own trial. The Fifth Amendment protects someone from being forced to either lie or inculpate themselves. But the preclusion of testimony prevents the jury from hearing the defendant's side of the story from his or her own mouth should they decide they want to present it. This, again, prevents a defendant from getting a fair trial, as often a defendant's state of mind is especially relevant as a material element of the crime. The defendant, then, is really the only individual who can actually take the stand and explain to the jury what he was thinking at the time. Without the ability to do that, the jury is left merely to guess. And if the defense cannot present concrete evidence of what the defendant was or was not thinking, which is a Herculean task without their testimony, the jury is likely to rely on the arguments made by the prosecutors to explain it. Hunter's case was exactly what you would expect. Through Washington and a few other eyewitnesses and documents, he laid out the narrative of how Brown had come to the town under an assumed name, put together his ragtag band of rioters, came into the town with the intention of seizing and looting the armory, fomenting a slave rebellion to tear Virginia and all the other southern states apart. During the course of the mayhem Brown had created, four Harpers Ferry residents wound up dead. Several more were injured, and the defendant had thus committed murder, treason against the Commonwealth of Virginia, and insurrection of a slave rebellion. Hiram Griswold gave the summation argument for John Brown. He made a few points which were, I think, pretty creative under the circumstances, but ultimately did not end up being persuasive. First, he said Brown had not personally shot and killed anyone, so he did not actually commit murder. That's fairly straightforward. Second, he said Brown had no loyalty to Virginia because he was not a Virginia resident. Thus, he cannot be found guilty of treason to a commonwealth which he owed no duty of loyalty to. Creative, but I would agree fairly unpersuasive. Third, he argued that because no slaves had actually joined the ranks, that the evidence was insufficient as a matter of law to show that he had actually fomented a slave rebellion. Now that, I think, could have some legs. Closing statements ended on November 2nd, 1859, just a week after the trial began. 45 minutes later, the jury returned a guilty verdict on all counts, and the sentence was death by hanging. Now, in Virginia at that time, there is a mandatory 30-day period between when a defendant was convicted and when they could be executed. Since the conviction was on November 2nd, he was sentenced to hang on December 2nd. But during the week of the trial, an odd thing had begun to happen. A phenomenon of humanity. There's something inside people that causes us to sympathize with someone who's being bullied, regardless of how we personally feel about them aside from the bully. Over the week between October 25th and November 2nd, John Brown played the role of Rocky Balboa in Rocky IV when Rocky fights Ivan Drago in Russia during the height of the Cold War. Initially, the crowd there hates the Western invader. He stands for everything they despise. His ideology is odious, and his very presence in their country is offensive. But during the course of the fight, they recognize something kindred about him. His courage, his passion, his willingness to keep coming back and take hit after hit without throwing in the towel, without complaining, because of the sheer will to attain his goal. Rocky takes punch after punch, and during the course of the fight, the crowd first tapers off in their hostility. Then you hear a few muffled cheers when he gets a few shots in. And by the end, there is a significant portion of the spectators who are cheering for this invader, this foreigner, who now is representing a spirit which they can relate to, the refusal to give up, no matter what. Now, that's obviously a Hollywood manufactured situation, but maybe Sylvester Stallone knew a thing or two about the John Brown trial. Harper's Ferry had been chosen as the site for John Brown's raid because the area was not subtle about its pro-slavery leanings. Brown wasn't just an unpopular figure there from the moment he appeared in town and took over the armory. He was a moral enemy. He was a foreign invader, an ideological foe. The people of the town were ready to watch him hang. But over the course of the trial, something quite unexpected happened. John Brown mustered all the dignity and strength that he could. He never complained about the rulings. He never indicated any dissatisfaction with the way he was treated. He never had a sharp word or nasty look at the people who very clearly were wishing death on him. He spent much of the early days laying on his pallet, and when he could muster the strength, he sat in a chair. He was courteous to the court. He was respectful to everyone involved. He was a true gentleman. Evidence presented during the trial showed Brown was not the monster he was initially portrayed as. It also came out that the men who Brown had held at the armory were treated quite well, despite being hostages. Witnesses testified that Brown had forbade his men to shoot at anyone unarmed, and no women or children under any circumstances, or even into houses where women or children might be. Public mood started to shift. Now remember that Brown himself could not testify. But there was also an order in place that Brown was not permitted to have any visitors. So the only information anyone received about him was from their personal observation of him in the courtroom or the testimony of witnesses about his behavior. And what they saw and heard over the course of the week changed their collective view of this man. He went from a monster who wanted to set fire to the very fabric of their society to a considerate and restrained, albeit zealous, advocate for human rights. He became an idea. The people of Harper's Ferry saw John Brown as a man, humble without being weak, and quiet without being resentful, but also as an advocate for a way of life. I like to picture the trial of John Brown to be like the fight between Rocky and Drago. I like the imagery of the rowdy courtroom on October 25th hurling insults and calling for Brown's head, while Brown endured everything and kept his cool day after day. I like the thought that the witnesses who testified against him had to admit that he had treated them with dignity and with kindness, that they had heard him forbid his men to take any action which could harm an innocent, and that he felt that he was called by God and could forge no other path. Picture onlookers in the gallery quietly whispering to each other small acknowledgments of respect, quiet enough that others wouldn't hear at first. And I picture when the verdict is read that Judge Parker and Andrew Hunter were probably expecting a chorus of applause from the benches, but they received silence. As we said, Brown's sentencing took place right then on November 2nd, the same day the verdict was handed down. And finally, the court recognized Brown and gave him the opportunity to make a statement. What followed was described by Ralph Waldo Emerson to be a speech whose oratory greatness was on par with the Gettysburg Address. It was quite brief, only 5 paragraphs, so I'll read it in full here. This is what John Brown said. "I have, may it please the court, a few words to say. In the first place, I deny everything, but what I have all along admitted, the design on my part to free the slaves. I intended certainly to have made a clean thing of that matter, as I did last winter when I went into Missouri and there took slaves without the snapping of a gun on either side, moved them through the country, and finally left them in Canada. I designed to have done the same thing again on a larger scale. That was all I intended. I never did intend murder, or treason, or the destruction of property, or to excite or incite slaves to rebellion, or to make insurrection. I have another objection, and that is, it is unjust that I should suffer such a penalty. Had I interfered in the manner which I admit, and which I admit has been fairly proved, for I admire the truthfulness and candor of the greater portion of the witnesses who have testified in this case. Had I so interfered on behalf of the rich, the powerful, the intelligent, the so-called great, or on behalf of any of their friends, either father, mother, brother, sister, wife, or children, or any of that class, and suffered and sacrificed what I have in this interference, it would have been all right. And every man in this court would have deemed it an act worthy of reward rather than punishment. This court acknowledges, as I suppose, the validity of the law of God. I see a book kissed here which I suppose to be the Bible, or at least the New Testament. That teaches me that all things whatsoever that I would have men should do to me, I should do even to them. It teaches me further to remember them that are in bonds as bound with them. I endeavor to act up to that instruction. I say I am yet too young to understand that God is any respecter of persons. I believe that to have interfered as I have done, as I have always freely admitted I have done, in behalf of his despised poor was not wrong but right. Now, if it is deemed necessary that I should forfeit my life for the furtherance of the ends of justice and mingle my blood further with the blood of my children and with the blood of millions in this slave country whose rights are disregarded by wicked, cruel, and unjust enactments, I submit, so let it be done. Let me say one word further. I feel entirely satisfied with the treatment I have received on my trial. Considering all the circumstances, it has been more generous than I expected. But I feel no consciousness of guilt. I have stated that from the first, what was my intention and what was not. I never had any design against the life of any person, nor any disposition to commit treason or excite slaves to rebel, or make any general insurrection. I never encouraged any man to do so, but always discouraged any idea of that kind. Let me say also a word in regard to the statements made by some of those connected with me. I hear it has been stated by some of them that I have induced them to join me, but the contrary is true. I do not say this to injure them, but as regretting their weakness. There is not one of them but joined me of his own accord, and the greater part of them at their own expense. A number of them I never saw and never had a word of conversation with till the day they came to me, and that was for the purpose I have stated. Now, I have done. As a courtroom lawyer, picturing John Brown standing up in court, and he could finally stand on his own at this time, delivering that speech, knowing what was going to happen to him, gives me goosebumps. Reporters copied it verbatim. It had appeared in 52 newspapers across the country. It was on the front page, top fold of the New York Times. Under Virginia law, as we said, there's a mandatory 30-day waiting period between a sentence of death and the execution itself. So Judge Parker sentenced Brown to die on December 2nd. The sentence being given, Brown could now have visitors. And every reporter on the Eastern Seaboard, especially those from Northern states, wanted to speak with him. And Brown would speak for hours with everyone and anyone who wanted to talk. In that month, he would send out over 100 letters, which were published frequently in regional newspapers. Abolitionists from all over the country came to meet with him and discuss his ideas for a post-slavery country and what it would look like. He encouraged them. He told them that the scourge of slavery could be ended if people had the will and the strength to do what needed to be done. He shared biblical passages with people who came to see him, parts of the Bible which he said gave him strength and comfort, and let him know that he had done the right thing. John Brown's name became a rallying cry for the abolitionist cause. Instead of keeping his trial quick and quiet, Brown would become a national martyr, and his followers would become even more vocal in their demands to end the practice of human ownership. He became as universally known as Frederick Douglass, and while many didn't agree with his use of violent methods, Brown won supporters with his passion and his constant support for the individual dignity of all humans. He was hanged on December 2, 1859, 46 days after the raid at Harper's Ferry. Less than 500 days later, shots were fired at Fort Sumter, and the Civil War began. In summation, I'm going to come at you with a bit of a hot take right now. You may have a gut reaction, but hear me out. It's okay to feel conflicted about John Brown's actions. I do. I wholeheartedly support his cause. Abolition was correct, and I see no defensible argument whatsoever for slavery. I think ending slavery in this country was worth fighting for. All of that, I'm squarely on Team John Brown. I'm not conflicted about the ideology, about the philosophy, or the moral code, which recognizes the inherent humanity in all of us, regardless of skin color or ethnicity, and that the idea of one human being owning another is an abhorrent practice. What I'm conflicted about is the means, the methodology to bring about the change Brown was looking for. He spent decades making speeches, raising money, lobbying the government, doing all the peaceful means of affecting legislation he could think of, but it wasn't making a difference. So John Brown decided that he would nudge freedom forward with the sword rather than with the pen. He wanted a Spartacus moment where slaves across the South would join his movement to overthrow their masters and follow him into his new paradise. I don't think for a second that John Brown ever wanted to hurt or kill anyone. But I believe that he had reconciled to himself that violence was necessary to achieve his goals and that people may have to die so he could accomplish the purpose which he believed God intended him for. That's where I have my issue. Brown spent a lot of time pressuring other outspoken abolitionists like Frederick Douglass to join in his raid or to use their considerable influence to encourage others to join. And almost none of them did, because they did not want to use violence to fight a violent system of oppression. But I recognize that it's easy for me in 2023 to feel queasy about Brown's raid and how it ended up killing 4 local residents and 11 of his own men. I acknowledge that perhaps I would think differently if I was an abolitionist in 1859 and I had soured on the speed which the government was moving to end this truly horrific practice. Especially in light of what was going on with the new states added to the Union and the Fugitive Slave Act. I don't know that I would have joined a raid which I knew or at least expected would result in interfering in the property rights of others or in their deaths, even if it was for the ultimate goal of ensuring unclaimed human rights for a huge swath of the population. I'm grateful that I've never been put in a situation where I had to make a choice like that. John Brown was a villain to some, a hero to many, and his actions were the strong gust of wind that knocked the small stone off a cliff where it began rolling down a snowy mountain, collecting more and more ice and snow until it became an unstoppable avalanche. And the United States would finally be forced to confront through armed struggle what type of country we were destined to be. So that's the case of John Brown, the abolitionist who wanted to incite a slave rebellion, a man who spent years planning a grand post-slave society, only to find himself going from raider to martyr in 46 days. There's no denying that his legacy lived on, and that during the course of his trial, he transitioned from man to idea. Special thanks, as always, to Dan Townsend, who edited today's program. Thank you, listeners of In Summation, for your support through 50 episodes of this program. I always appreciate the insightful comments I get and the discussions they generate. Please keep the comments flowing. And always feel free to push back on anything you disagree with. It's come to a point where I now recognize that I no longer need to remind people that. Many people seem very eager to let me know exactly where they disagree with me, but that's fine. I really do appreciate it. Agree or disagree. If you want to get in touch with me to push back or to express agreement. If you want to give me a topic or a case to cover, if you want to ask a question about criminal law, or just send me a message unrelated to the show. You can email me at insummationpodcast@gmail.com. You can tweet me at insummationpod. I'm on Instagram at insummation. You can visit the show's website, insummation.com, or check out the show's Facebook page. You can also look me up on my law firm's website, robertcgottlieblaw.com. I really try to be good about responding, and I think most people would agree that I get back to people pretty quickly. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the show. If you rate and review it, it'll help other people find it as well. If you're new, please feel free to check out the entire catalog. If you want to discuss any of the cases beyond where the episode went, please reach out. It's the reason I keep doing it. So as always, thanks for stopping by, and I hope that you'll come back for more.